Support for this podcast comes from The Huntington, presenting Toni Stone, Play Ball. Witness the remarkable true story of the first woman to play professional baseball on a man's team, shattering expectations and creating her own set of rules. Now through June 16th at The Huntington Theater, huntingtontheater.org.
Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. VP fever, Homegate, and troops in the news this week, U.S. and Russian. By late week at a peanut shop in Virginia, Barack Obama said he had made his VP choice. And that's all he said.
I made the selection, and that's all you're going to get.
John McCain didn't know or didn't want to talk about how many homes he owns.
How many houses do you and Mrs. McCain have?
I think I'll let my staff get to you. I've got to tell you about
it. It's 7. We learn maybe 8. A new deal between U.S. and Iraqi negotiators pictures U.S. troops out of Iraq by 2011. Hushyar Zebari, Iraq's foreign minister, called it historic.
What we have accomplished in this agreement is the most advanced version of any so far strategic agreement between the United States and any other country in the world.
And Russian tanks on the move in Georgia, though at week's end, we're not sure in what direction. This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable, goes behind the headlines. You can join the conversation. What's your top story this week? What do you make now of Russia, of Olympic China, of McCain and Obama neck and neck in the polls, of U.S. aspirational goals, that's what they're calling it, for a 2011 pullout from Iraq? Joining us today from Washington, D.C. is Eleanor Clift, contributing editor for Newsweek magazine. Eleanor, welcome back to On Point.
Good to be with you.
Great to have you. And with us from Washington, Matt Continetti, associate editor for the Weekly Standard. Matt, welcome back to you as well.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty, senior editor of the Atlantic Monthly, joins us. Jack, welcome. Great to have you.
Tom, today I'm speaking from my Hanover house, but tomorrow, okay. Should you need me, I'm going to be staying at one of my other houses. I just can't remember which one. You know, it's not easy keeping track of the darn things. My staff will get back to you.
Great. Let's go right to what Barack Obama made of that. Here's, there's the interview with McCain, unclear about the number it appeared, and then Obama's campaign turning that moment into this ad.
John McCain said, "The fundamentals of our economy are strong." Then again, that same day, when asked how many houses he owns, McCain lost track. He couldn't remember. Well, it's 7. 7 houses. And here's one house America can't afford to let John McCain move into.
And of course, that one in Obama's ad is the White House. Matt Continetti, what do you make of House Flap?
Well, I think, you know, it was right for Obama to hit McCain on this lapse in memory. The problem for Obama, I think, is that it doesn't play into the narrative of McCain, right? I mean, the narrative of McCain, why McCain shouldn't be president, according to liberals and Democrats, is that he's just another Bush term. It's not that he's an out-of-touch elitist, which was the narrative with John Kerry, why John Kerry shouldn't be president in 2004. And so then all of John Kerry's homes and, you know, his windsurfing and everything, when that was pointed out, it fit into a narrative. This doesn't really fit into the McCain narrative, so I think it will pretty much die once Obama names his VP choice.
Eleanor Clift, how are you watching this race, House Flap and all the rest? The polls really closing, just maybe a 3-point gap here. Obama's lead down from 6. I think that's an NBC Wall Street Journal poll. That is, in statistical terms, essentially neck and neck. What's going on?
Well, I'm always struck by the seeming serenity of the Obama people. They look at the national polls and they say it was always a myth to think that Obama could break away and be leading, but he is ahead in just about every poll, I think, except one outlier poll. John Zogby had McCain pulling ahead. But Democrats are really nervous, and now along comes the House gift, and I think you did see the Obama campaign get off the mat and respond very quickly, and I beg to differ a little bit from that. I do think that it does play into the narrative, because the economy is the top issue in this campaign, and McCain in the past has said he doesn't know much about the economy, and this week he pronounced the fundamentals are strong, and then he's got all these houses he doesn't know how many he owns or lives in, and it does remind one of the moment in 1992 when the former President Bush, running for re-election, didn't seem to know what a supermarket scanner was. And I think it does point up the out-of-touch quality. So I think this is a boost for Obama going into his convention and a boost he badly needed.
Jack, what do you make of the moment? Here we are on the eve of the Democrats' convention. We'll be there with them in Denver next week and then with the Republicans in St. Paul in Minnesota. Obama had a great big spring and triumph in the Democratic primaries, and he had a bigger lead a month ago than he does now. As we head into these conventions, Jack, how do you take stock of the two campaigns?
Well, I think that McCain had what I call a crossover moment in July. That is to say, his ads, especially the Paris Hilton ad and other ads focusing not just on Obama's elitism, but on the vapidity of the Obama campaign, change you can believe in, hope and so on, that really crossed over. And what it crossed over is the barrier between the political class, people who pay attention to these things, and the vast, the number of Americans who don't. And that's a big, big number. In a poll of 2004, a National Election Survey, there was a seven question poll to people. You know, who was the vice president? What office does William Rehnquist hold? Out of 1,000 people, only two got all of them right. There's a great gap in political information. So when you cross over, it's something that people can remember. Yes, Obama is vapid, and yeah, we get it through the Paris Hilton thing. Well, I think now Obama's had his crossover moment. People don't have to know a heck of a lot about, medical, who has the best medical plan, but they can get this. They can get the connection between seven houses and the economy looks good to me. And so I think this is one of those crossover moments where through a symbolic ad and a symbolic moment, more and more people can get a sense of what's going on.
Let's hear from the two candidates here. Beyond the back and forth over homes and houses, there were back and forths over patriotism and judgment and Iraq. Here's Barack Obama. This is in his speech to the Veterans of Foreign Wars in Orlando, Florida, on Tuesday, criticizing John McCain, who he said had questioned his patriotism.
I have never suggested and never will that Senator McCain picks his positions on national security based on politics or personal ambition. I've not suggested it because I believe that he genuinely wants to serve America's national interests. Now it's time for him to acknowledge that I want to do the same. Let me be clear. I will let no one question my love of this country.
The next day, at a town hall meeting in Las Cruces, New Mexico, John McCain said, okay, I'm not going after Obama's patriotism, but questioned his judgment on the troop surge in Iraq.
No rational observer could go to Iraq and see what we've succeeded in doing in the last 2 years and say that the surge hasn't succeeded. That's what this is all about, my friends. This is what it's all about, securing our nation. Even in retrospect, with all we know today, he'd still choose the path of retreat and failure. You know, yesterday, Senator Obama got a little testy on this issue. He said, I'm questioning his patriotism. Let me be very clear. I am not questioning his patriotism. I am questioning his judgment. I am questioning his judgment.
Eleanor Clift, is John McCain on a successful strategy message right there?
Well, his slogan is putting country first. I remember Bill Clinton ran on putting people first. Putting country first suggests that your opponent somehow doesn't. And I think that McCain has drawn blood over the summer by implying that Barack Obama does not have the credentials to lead the country. And I think that's a legitimate line of attack. But I think he is veering into the personal, and I think the only way that McCain can win this campaign, he can't, I don't believe, put himself forward with a clarion message. He has to bring down Obama. And the only way he does that is to penetrate the character issues that Obama has raised simply by being such a phenomenon in this race.
We had an ad there from Barack Obama. Here's one from the McCain camp. Send up and made in advance of the Democratic National Convention jabs at Barack Obama's reputation as the one.
In Denver, you will see the light.
A light will shine down from somewhere. It will light upon you. You will experience an epiphany. And you will say to yourself, I have to vote for Barack.
So let it be written. So let it be done.
He may be the one, but is he ready to lead? No.
Complete, it sounds like, with Yul Brynner from the Ten Commandments. Matt Continetti, does this work for John McCain? Is his judgment in the gut of the American electorate so superior that this makes it a vulnerability for Barack Obama?
I think it does. I think Jack was on to something when he said that, you know, this is the celebrity critique of Obama, or how the RNC is putting their slogan for the Denver convention is a mile high and an inch deep, right? He's a great celebrity. He's a great speaker, but there's not much there otherwise. That has seeped through to the major, to the majority of the electorate. I mean, look, McCain has a message, which is that message, the celebrity message, and he also has two issues. One was the surge issue, which we heard from him just a few moments ago, and there's also the drilling issue, on which he's still with the, you know, with the overwhelming majority of the country, according to popular opinion polls. So he has a message, he has a couple of issues, and so far it's been a pretty good late summer for John McCain.
And yet you look around the world and around the country at the stack of troubles waiting for whomever steps into the White House next January, and it hardly looks like a great gift from 8 years of Republican presidency. That looks like it would be a big rock to carry, Matt.
Sure, and it is, and that's why Obama still leads in a lot of these polls, even though you know they're all mainly within the majority, the margin of error. But the fact is, you know, this is less about McCain winning the election than it is about Obama losing it. And I think if there were another Democrat running, Hillary Clinton as the nominee, that lead would be much, much higher. I mean, look, if you look at the generic numbers, people prefer the Democratic generic candidate by double digits.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about a week in the news, VP fever, Russians still in Georgia, and an aspirational exit date, end of 2011, for U.S. troops in Iraq, we are told. We're joined by Eleanor Clift of Newsweek, Matt Continetti of the Weekly Standard, and our own Jack Beatty. Here's Barack Obama today on CBS's The Early Show, talking about the three things he said he's looking for when deciding on a running mate.
Obviously, the most important question is this person prepared to be president? Second most important question from my perspective is, can this person help me govern? Are they going to be an effective partner in creating the kind of economic opportunity here at home and guiding us through some dangerous waters internationally? And the third criteria for me, I think, was independence. I want somebody who is going to be able to challenge my thinking and not simply be a yes person.
Barack Obama laying out his criteria today. And, of course, that announcement expected very, very soon. He'll be in Springfield, Illinois tomorrow. That is Saturday morning. And everyone's assuming he'll be there with a VP pick at his side. Eleanor Clift, what do you think it's coming down to? I mean, no one knows, I guess. They've been incredibly successful at keeping this tight and buttoned up. But what are you anticipating?
Well, the intense buzzing seems to be circulating around Delaware Senator Joe Biden in these last several days. And he would bring the foreign relations expertise, I think, that Obama is notably lacking. And he certainly is not afraid to speak his mind. He sometimes speaks his mind at great length. And you'll remember at the start of the election season, Senator Biden got in some trouble when he referred to Senator Obama as clean and articulate. And it was one of those early little race sensitivities that we experienced in this campaign. Senator Obama apparently didn't take it in any way that it was not intended, and he likes Joe Biden, and Biden brings working class credentials, which is a segment of the electorate that Senator Obama has had trouble connecting with. So I think there are some assets that Senator Biden brings to the ticket, if in fact he is the one, and we don't know that.
Matt Continetti from your more conservative perch at the Weekly Standard, how are you assessing the algebra over there, the calculus of Obama's selection?
Well, I think a lot of Republicans, Tom, are hoping that Obama picks Senator Biden just because he's been around forever. And as Eleanor points out, he has a tendency, I call it Joe Bidenitis, which is, you know, this kind of logorrhea of the mouth. He just talks and talks and talks and talks. And you can always pick out things there to attack or make fun of if you're running against him. So and of course, the Biden pick would also cut against Obama's whole call for change. I mean, here's a Washington hand. He's been around forever. I would think Obama really likes Governor Tim Kaine of Virginia, a Catholic. He's been able to connect with rural voters there the same way that former Governor Democrat Mark Warner did. And, of course, Obama really wants to win Virginia in November, and Kaine may help there. So, yeah, I think Biden, Kaine, and then there's always Senator Evan Bay is in the mix as well.
Jack Beatty, how's your supercomputer running the options here?
Well, you know, I rather hope that he does pick somebody from Washington because it will show that he's not enthralled to this change mantra. This has run. That's played out. You know, in the Democratic primaries, that was clear. The longer it went on, the worse he did, especially among working class voters. You know, a woman out in Pennsylvania this week talking about what people out there think. She says people around here want pragmatic, practical language. They don't want to hear highfalutin talk about change and hope and all the rest. They want to hear about, you know, as a turn of the century politician put it, liberty in the groceries. And so I really hope he shows some freedom from that played out mantra. But the choice of Biden presents problems. Biden has said a lot, and he said a lot about how good John McCain is. National Review Online has a whole sheet of all the great things he said about John McCain, including, yeah, he could probably be president. And it also has a sheet of the things he said critical of Obama. All of that will come back and back and back. If he's the nominee.
So a thumbs up if it's Biden from your corner. Let's begin to turn to our listeners in Augusta, Georgia. We've got John calling in. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I'm a newly registered voter, and I've been, you know, watching the election pretty closely. And I've seen just a slight bit of inaccuracy, especially when it comes to the results of the polls. There has been a surge in voter registration from new registered voters, and those results, I'm sure, are not recorded yet. And also, I'd like to say that it's also been a little bit biased that Barack Obama has been under increased scrutiny. I mean, ever since the primary season, I mean, he's been hammered by position after position, but John McCain is enjoying a pretty much a free ride because, I mean, he's not really been questioned on really whether he's able to do the things that he's claiming on doing, but he's not been really scrutinized as Barack Obama has. He's been scrutinized not only by the Democratic Party, but also by the Republican Party. And so I feel like if John McCain is actually scrutinized the same way that Barack Obama is, that we will see a whole different result in the way that these results are coming out.
John, let us look at that, and thanks for calling from Augusta. Eleanor Clift, how about it on these polls? I have seen side-by-side comparisons of national polling versus electoral numbers. I've seen them stacked up to say that Barack Obama is way ahead in the electoral count, even if it's closer in the overall national poll. What do you know about that?
That's right. You need 270 electoral votes to win, and I think their internal account, the campaign internal account, has them at 217, with a lot more options to get to the 270 than McCain has coming from, I think he's up in the high 170s. And, you know, you do have some people, you know, predicting that Obama could win with 350 electoral votes in an electoral landslide. And the key is really that they have to change the face of the electorate, and they keep saying that, and they're spending a lot of money on voter registration.
John in Augusta says they're doing it.
That's right. And they've got, you know, 14 offices in Alaska, which is a Republican stronghold. McCain has none. Obama is 5 points ahead in North Dakota, a state he's probably not going to win. But if he forces McCain to spend $500,000 there. That's a $500,000 he doesn't have for Ohio. And so Obama has the resources to play across the board. And if he, in fact, boosts the number of voters under 30, they normally vote at about 30% of their numbers. If he can get that up to 50%, and if he can get African-American voters up from voting rates in the low 50s to the low 70s, he'll add 3 or 4 million people to the electorate, and boom, you've got a big win. So I think it's possible.
Let's get a call from Spencer, Iowa, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was just telling your screener that I thought that, McCain is probably the Paris Hilton of the Republican Party. If he can't remember how many homes he has, I'm trying to keep track of how I'm going to pay for one utility bill. I can imagine the confusion that he must have. I guess when I think about McCain as president, I look back at the early flagging days of his campaign when he had so much difficulty keeping a campaign in order that it was floundering and falling apart. He had to go in and dress people down and throw a fit. It makes me wonder what would happen as president if he had a huge staff and he had to keep track of them. Maybe he's, you know, keeping track of his homes and not keeping track of his campaign is what happened there. But
Jim, we've got the gist. Let us get another one from Iowa right here. West Point, Iowa. Jay, you're on the air.
Yeah, what I want to say is I really respect McCain about making a change with our economy. And then in the caucuses here, I heard Phil Graham as a red flag, the one that brought us Enron, the one that started this mortgage fiasco.
Big advisor to John McCain, yeah.
He denounced him after the whiner and the it's all in our mind. And he denounced him and got rid of him. But it's all a pattern now. We got the $5 million comment at Saddleback. And now this House thing, and then I go back to this Phil Graham. Who in the media is going to ask him, how much of your economy plan is the same as Phil Graham's? Because nobody asks that, and I'm fed up.
Matt Continetti, I want to hear you on this, but Jack Beatty, I know you've paid a lot of attention to Phil Graham, not your favorite guy, but of course he was at John McCain's side on the economy. What do you say?
Well, I think this is an incubus for McCain. You know, the McCain plan is very, very favorable to the wealthy. I pointed out before that the top 0.01% under McCain pick up an extra $700,000 a year. Under Obama, they lose $300,000 a year. That's a big swing. I mean, he's going to be really, really good for the wealthy. And is that really what the public wants? It doesn't seem to be. And Graham, I think, emphasizes that. And so I think all of this, the comment about the $5 million, Phil Graham.
What is rich? He was asked by Pastor Rick Warren. He was kind of joking there, but still, that was the number.
You know, the Republicans are good at cultural populism, at somehow casting Democrats as elitists because they eat arugula or something. Well, now here's a moment of economic populism. For the first time, Barack has one, and it'll be he really has to play it for all it's worth, and probably it's unfortunate that his vice presidential pick is coming so soon because he could flog this for the whole weekend otherwise.
Matt Continetti, how about it? You said earlier you don't think the how many houses question plays into the significant narrative of the campaign, but then the economy is a pretty significant threat here, and our caller from Iowa is seeing in that light. I can't pay my utility bills. He doesn't know how many homes he owns.
Right, and I think Jack is correct to say that Obama may be stepping on his own story here by picking his vice presidential nominee right when he's kind of gaining traction, perhaps, with this economic argument against McCain. I still think, though, it's a hard sell just because when most people in the public think John McCain, they think war hero, they think, you know, POW, they think foreign policy. It's going to be hard to kind of get them to start thinking, oh, he's a plutocrat, he married to the beer heiress, he doesn't know how many homes he owns, and here I am struggling. But if he's able to do that, Obama is, I think it'd be an effective critique. And I also agree, McCain's economic plan doesn't do enough for the middle class. You know, a lot of conservatives here in Washington have been talking for some time about the so-called Sam's Club Republicans. These are working-class Republicans who want to vote Republican on cultural or even national security issues. but they, you know, they don't like this economic agenda. And I wish McCain's economic policies were more geared to them rather than, you know, just talking about lowering the corporate tax rate, which may be a good idea, but it's hard to get people excited about that as opposed to, you know, a middle-class tax cut.
Democrats meet next week, the GOP just the week after in St. Paul. What do you feel as the enthusiasm in the GOP for John McCain going in or approaching now that the Republican convention, Matt?
Well, I mean, I think the Republicans are going to be on the attack. There's no question about it. But the convention presents a big moment for Obama. And, you know, we'll see how the public responds to his Invesco Field speech, whether he's going to be able to kind of convince them that he is this grand orator who's able to summon 70,000 people at will, or whether they're going to respond to it and say, listen, this guy has an ego the size of the stadium he's addressing. And they may find that distasteful.
Let's go to Steve in Arlington, Massachusetts. Steve, you're on the air.
Hello there, Tom.
Hi.
Yes. I'm interested in how come Obama doesn't ask McCain about the Justice Department, Monica Goodling, or the EPA, or about the missing emails, or about Scooter Libby. How come the Democratic Party doesn't emphasize what has been going on and ask McCain, does he disagree with this? Would he never do anything? Or signing statements or something which asks McCain what he thinks about what has gone on.
Steve, let us pick it up. Eleanor Cliff, the Bush dirty laundry list. Steve wishes that Barack Obama would hang it around John McCain's neck. Do you see him not doing that? Is there more room for it, and why not?
Well, I think the campaign is not going to be a referendum on George W. Bush. I think the voters have already relegated him to history. And I think that the campaign does have to connect him to Bush policies. But I think the issues that the caller raised are considered more, you know, inside baseball for activists. And I think that Obama is trying to broaden the critique against McCain at this stage of the race, really to the economy. That is the big one. And, you know, I think that you don't want to get too mired in details that a lot of people can't really follow. And I think the convention is really going to be about setting out an indictment of the last 8 years so that when Bush talks, when I'm getting all these characters mixed up, when Obama talks about change, he can explain what he wants to change from. And the next 70 days are very important for Obama with the vice presidential pick, the conventions, and finally the debates. And the notion that he's an empty suit celebrity will be dismissed when he takes that stage.
Jack Beatty, put yourself in an Obama advice circle for a moment. Do you think you ought to go harder after the sort of big heap of problems left from the Bush administration and some of the dirty laundry there? Or, as Eleanor says, is he right to sort of point ahead, push ahead? Could he tie it to John McCain? Should he?
I don't think he can convincingly. I think he can tie the tax issues and inequality issues very well to McCain because of the program. But, for example, on signing statements, McCain has been very clear on that.
This is presidential signing statements.
That's right.
Exempt him from the law.
He has criticized that, and he has said that that's not a practice he would indulge in to any degree. I don't know about the other matters. I don't think there's much profit there. I think the profit for Obama really is in empathy, in talking about the dilemmas the people have in their economic lives today. Joe Sestak, the Democratic congressman in the Philly suburbs, told E.J. Dionne, you know, it's not so much about whether they know him, the voters. They want to know that he knows them. I think that's the key for him, to connect with the dilemmas of people facing, for example, this winter, a $1,900 increase on average people are going to be facing in oil heating bills in the Northeast, $1,900 for the year. He's got to talk about that. He's got to talk about the proportion of adults with whose deductibles on insurance, medical insurance, has doubled just since 2003. He's got to really get down to the problems people have, and he's got to propound the politics of remedy. We can deal with this. Government can deal with this. Government can help.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other headlines this week, the U.S. women's soccer team beat Brazil 1-0 to take Olympic gold yesterday after Carly Lloyd scored this goal in the sixth minute of overtime.
Touchdown to spin. Oh, Rodriguez couldn't get through. Lloyd steps up. Reverse shot.
Democratic Congresswoman Stephanie Tubbs Jones of Ohio died Wednesday. In May, we talked with her about the race for the Democratic nomination. What a woman. 91% of African Americans in North Carolina voting for Obama. You're African American. If your candidate,
a beautiful, gorgeous African American woman, I am.
No, yeah. No less than that. No less than that. And cell phones across India can now ring to the sound of safe sex, a new ringtone funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, downloaded big time. And yes, they're singing Condom. Oh boy. Fun with condoms and ringtones and the AIDS campaign in India. Eleanor Clift is with us from Newsweek magazine. Matt Continetti is here from the Weekly Standard and our own Jack Beatty. Let's take a call from Toronto, Canada. And Chris, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
It seems to me that the U.S. is intent on provoking some kind of a confrontation with Russia. The you see the proxy war the U.S. is engaged in Georgia. You see the militarization of Eastern and Central Europe with the recent agreement to station bases and radar stations and military silos in that part of the world. And I'm just wondering how far this will go. Will we go through some kind of confrontation where the U.S. backs the Ukraine over the least strategic naval ports that Russia has in the Black Sea, and which would possibly lead to a nuclear crisis.
Yeah, you are not alone, Chris, in wondering how far this goes. Let's listen for just a moment to Condoleezza Rice telling CNN here on Wednesday that Russian troops then were still in Georgia and that Russian President Dmitry Medvedev was breaking promises.
The Russian president is beginning to sound like a broken record. First, his troops were going to be out on Monday. Then his troops were going to be out on Wednesday. Now his troops are going to be out on Friday. I'm beginning to wonder if the Russian president is ever going to keep his word.
Matt Continetti, what is this new world we're stepping into? How do you see the dangers here? Or is it a new world or just a lot of breastfeeding?
I think it's hysterical that Secretary Rice is just beginning to think that President Medvedev and Putin, the actual ruler of Russia, don't keep their word. I mean, this is amazing. The Russian idea of a ceasefire is fantastic. It means you cease fire and I continue to occupy your country. Mm. As for the caller's point, I think it's interesting. It leaves out totally Russia's actions. I mean, let's not forget who actually invaded Georgia. It was Russia. Now, even if Russia wanted to create the status quo ante after Saakashvili ordered his troops into that breakaway province south of Ossetia, they could have just occupied South Ossetia, where they already were, as peacekeeping, quote-unquote, forces. Instead, they invaded a sovereign country, something they haven't done since the end of the Cold War. So I think both sides here clearly are engaging in different, you know, diplomatic moves that may be conceived of as a saber-rattling. But in terms of the Eastern European countries, the former Soviet Union countries, I mean, they're the ones coming toward America and NATO and the European Union because they're afraid of Russia. It's not necessarily us, you know, the United States ganging up on them and forcing them to join these alliances. I mean, look what happened with Poland. They were negotiating with us, the Americans, forever about these this missile interceptor deal. But as soon as Russia invaded Georgia, they agreed to the terms and wanted that that deal signed because they're afraid.
Eleanor Clift, I don't know what the right answer is here, but it sure doesn't look like a big, bold, and strong U.S. and NATO in the last week and a half as Russia moves around.
What's been exposed is how few cards to play that the U.S. has in relationship to a newly resurgent, oil-rich Russia. And I think the Bush administration, you know, egged on the Georgian president, and I think he went too far. I mean, he in effect started it by launching a crackdown on the separatist province, and I think the Russians probably welcomed that because it was a chance for them to display their might, and the U.S. and Georgia inevitably had to back down. And then moving ahead with the stalling this missile system, which doesn't even work, in Poland, just sort of sticking it in the Russian eye, seems to me unnecessarily provocative at a time when the U.S. is not in a position to follow through with all the tough words. And John McCain saying we're all Georgians now, the implication of that, if he were president, could be really scary.
Jack, I want to get you on that, but let me get Lou in Buffalo, New York first. Lou, you're on the air.
Yeah, Tom, hey, thanks for taking the call.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't know what Georgia was thinking on this, to be honest with you. I mean, we were knee-deep in all kinds of international and domestic trouble in 1968. We're celebrating the 40th anniversary of Russia jumping in on Czechoslovakia.
Observing it anyway. Yep,
before
yep.
That, yeah, before that was Hungary. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, we gave them tough Cold War responses verbally and diplomatically, but we didn't send in our troops. I mean, what was Georgia thinking? We're not going to send in troops now. NATO's not going to send in troops. I mean, to do that against the big bear is going to create a World War III situation. And you got to be realistically and realize that. I mean, what's her name? Kathleen Parker. Vlad, you've got mail. She wrote a column this last week, and it was humorous. There was the George Bush take on it, you know, with looking into his eyes and seeing his soul, and then there was the Tommy, still there?
Yeah, I'm there. I don't know that particular bit of humor, but the looking into the soul is starting to sound too bitterly funny.
The Obama email, which had this real, like, flowing soliloquies, all these big words, et cetera, and then you had, then it came down to McCain, and it simply said, Putin, don't make me come over there. I mean, I'm pulling for Obama, but geez, I mean, McCain at least he was tougher, and he's just a presidential candidate.
Yeah, I don't know. The sound that he has in my ear this week is that sound of tank treads. Lou, thanks for that. Jack. Lou says, you got to be realistic. The U.S. and NATO are not going to stand up to this oil-rich and now increasingly armed Russia. On the other hand, things have changed in the last 40 years. Poland is now part of NATO.
Poland is part of NATO, and this agreement they have, this bilateral security agreement they want with us, they've achieved with us, is frightening because it pledges us to aid Poland if Poland is menaced, us directly, not going even through NATO. The Russians say, quote, our response will go beyond diplomacy to the deployment both of the short-range, both of the missile interceptors and the short-range rockets. You know, Poland was invaded in 1953 again by the Soviets, again in 1980. We did nothing. Now we have, because we weren't obliged to, now our security ambit has gone to a country and a region where we have no vital interests. And, you know, it's tantamount, really, to Russia reaching a security agreement with Mexico. And what we would feel about that, I think we know. This whole business of NATO enlargement, as George Kennan said years ago, may turn out to be a world historic mistake because of the nationalist reaction it almost inevitably provoked in Russia.
Matt, I want to get you on that. Let me get Sandra first from Virginia, Mount Jackson, Virginia. Hi, Sandra. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Eleanor and gentlemen. I'm calling from the beautiful Shenandoah Valley, but my question is a broad one. Could we not broaden the discussion about national security, not to be taking the word of the generals for policy, but rather to have a policy in which the military is one function?
Where are you pointing there? To George Bush, who says, I want to hear from the generals? I mean, everybody seems to want to turn.
Well, I'm saying that if we could present a change, if Senator Obama were to do that, when Obama is hopefully able to do something different and McCain still stands for the military, obviously that's his strength, that the military perhaps is not the only answer to national security.
Let us pick it up, Sandra. Thanks for your call. Matt Continetti, Lou in Buffalo, worries about a new Cold War. Jack is worried about commitments made to Poland here, not just NATO, but bilateral, saying we'll come in to defend you if and when. You hear Sandra saying, let's not just have a general's approach to this. Let's broaden the mural. What do you say, Matt?
Sure. I mean, a lot of people think, as Sandra does, there's a great book called Smart Power Out, and Joe Nye, of course, coined the term at Harvard. Mm. I think it's fascinating when people consider, they seem to ignore the fact of a Russian general threatening nuclear war on democratic, independent Poland, and yet then they call the signing of a missile deal in order to protect Poland from the Russians with the United States as somehow provocative. I mean, there's this tendency to somehow leave Russia out of the conversation. And, of course, Russia and Mexico would never sign a security agreement, because Mexico is a democracy allied with the United States. I mean, as Poland wants to be. And so I think we need to treat the national aspirations of these sovereign democratic peoples who lived under the yoke of the Soviet Empire for decades, and before that were occupied by the Nazis. I mean, I think we should treat them as our equals and listen to what they want to say and support them if necessary. That doesn't mean World War III, but that does mean, you know, actually reaching out and helping our friends and distinguishing our friends from our rivals, as Russia is turning into, it seems to me.
But what does it mean, Matt, for the GOP in a period when the U.S. is stretched, strapped militarily? Everybody, all the generals themselves have said there's not a whole lot more we can do here. What does that support mean? How much can the U.S. sign up and deliver on when it comes to standing up to a more assertive Russia?
Sure. Well, there are plenty of things we could do. We could dissolve the G8 and reconstitute the G7, which was originally an alliance of democracies there. I mean, we can embargo perhaps the 2014 Sochi Olympics. We're right across the border from the country that Russia just invaded a few weeks ago. And these are diplomatic moves, you know. And, of course, this is not just a GOP thing, Tom. Richard Holbrooke is mm-hmm. in the Washington Post today mm-hmm. saying that we need to support Georgia by helping to rebuild that country. This is a kind of a conversation when it comes to the new Russian power that cuts across the parties. And, Joe Biden, for example, now pledging a $1 billion supplemental to help the Georgians. So this is not just a GOP issue. This is a bipartisan issue. And I think no matter who is president, Obama or McCain, you're going to see either man really make strong commitments to Georgia, to Ukraine, and to Poland.
Let's go to Charleston, South Carolina, and Carter. Hi, Carter. You're on the air.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Pretty well.
My question is, everybody talk about how weak our military is. Our Navy and our Air Force really haven't been put to the test. And I think with Iran and Al-Qaeda and Russia on the horizon, we do have a strong Navy and we do have a strong Air Force that can go over there and handle those situations. And my question is, do we want an appeaser in Obama? Do we want somebody that's going to stand up and be kind of almost Ronald Reagan, like stand up for America and stand up for American values as in McCain?
Carter, let me ask you something right on that, and I respect your point of view, but let me ask you, George Bush has been in the White House for 8 years with that U.S. Navy and Air Force and Army, and we still haven't wrapped up Iraq or even Afghanistan, for that matter.
And we haven't been attacked since 9/11 also.
But I mean, if we've...
In my opinion, George Bush has been an outstanding commander-in-chief. And the reason he's probably not going over there dealing with Russia is because of the left-wing news media and because of the appeasers in this country. If we go over there and get in it and step on the side with Georgia, the media and the leftists in this country will have a fit.
Carter, let us pick it up while we've got time. And Matt, I'm going to come to you again first on that. You're with the Conservative Weekly Standard. Do you think a left-wing media has tied George Bush down for the last 8 years?
No. I mean, I think Bush's mistakes have tied him down. But I think the caller is right. I mean, when we talk about military overstretch, we're talking about the Army and the Marine Corps, which were not expanded after 9/11 as they should have been in order to cope with the numerous challenges America faces in the world. But relatively speaking, the Navy and the Air Force are still there and have not been, you know, committed to the fight, you know, in terms of deployments or whatnot, as the Army and Marines.
Jack, it does make you wonder about the shape of the world. Carter's there; he wants to, you know, muster out the boys and girls as well now, and just, you know, put the hammer down. And yet, we spent billions and billions trying to do that here and there, and we don't have conclusions yet. Do you see excess capacity, whether it's McCain or Obama in the White House, to roll out and roll on?
Doesn't appear to be. New York Times headline the other day, Afghanistan on fire. They point out we could, quote, lose this war. There's no hot pursuit there because of the border with Pakistan. What are we going to do there if the Pakistan government won't allow us to go across there? And then the issue with Russia, you know, we have larger interests with Russia that I think Carter needs to take into account. One of them is controlling the proliferation of nuclear weapons. There's all sorts of loose nukes around in the former Soviet Union. We need to work with them to contain them. We need to work with them to pressure Iran pulling back from the brink. We have transcendent common interests with Russia that outweigh any connection we may have, which is purely notional and verbal, with Georgia. So I think the world is, you know, you really, sometimes you have to work with people you don't like because you share a common problem with them.
Eleanor, we've just got half a minute. Maybe transcendent common interest, but do you think we're headed back into Cold War posture, language, and all the rest? Are those transcendent interests
going to... We're going to have a new president in January who will be keenly aware of the limitations of U.S. power. And the notion that we would kick out Russia from the G8, first of all, the other members of the G8 might have something to say about that. And isolation hasn't worked so well as a policy under the Bush years. And boycotting the Olympics, I mean, that's hardly a big hammer to carry. It didn't work for Jimmy Carter in 1980. So, I think there's going to be some realism brought back to the White House. And I actually think President Bush has been more muted during the recent crisis than he might have been earlier in his tenure as president.
Mm. Well, a week of shifting gears abroad and in the campaign at home. We'll be off to Denver and then to St. Paul in the week or two ahead. I want to thank each of my guests today for being with us. Eleanor Clift at Newsweek. Eleanor, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Matt Continetti at the Weekly Standard. Always great to have you, Matt. Thanks very much for being here.
Thanks, Tom.
And Jack Beatty, have a great weekend. Thanks for being here, Jack.
Thank you, Tom.
Talk to you next from Denver there. Listeners, you can continue the conversation at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.